Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Marvin Smith, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, we will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. As I'm sure many of you expected to hear Marvin's voice with me this morning, well, he is spending time with his family, but he will be back with us next week on the air, so tune in then. Now, stay with us as we now talk about a subject that is very interesting to me, which are some of the myths of child development. Our guest today, Dr. Stephen Hupp, has a PhD in clinical psychology from Louisiana State University. He's a professor of psychology at Southern Illinois University, where he coordinates the clinical child track and school psychology master's degree program. Dr. Hupp is a licensed clinical psychologist and the behavioral health consultant for the St. Clair County Head Start program. He is also the co-author of the book, Great Myths of Child Development, which is the topic of our show today. Dr. Hupp, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I appreciate you being on with us. I think many of us, as parents, we go out there and we immediately start to gather information. And sometimes it's talking with our own parents, our own grandparents, it's reading books. And what we find is there's a lot of myths out there. So how did you decide which myths to describe in your book?
One of the main things that really drew me in was if I believed the myth myself at some point, and there were topics that I even believed until the day I started trying to sit down and write about them, and those were kind of my favorite topics, if I believed it, or just if I had some evidence to show a lot of people believe the myth.
Well, now explain to our listeners what some of those topics were, and you know, especially the ones that you cover in your book.
Well, one of the ones I kind of had to change my thinking on was this notion that identical twins have identical DNA. I've always been taught that. I think most people have been taught that if they take a child development class. And basically, it's largely true. Identical twins do have very, very similar DNA, but because of what's called copy number variants, or the way cells replicate each other when we're developing as an embryo, there's actually slight variations even in the DNA of identical twins. And so that was something I learned, and we turned it into a myth.
Well, that's funny because, I mean, as you were saying that, I immediately thought of like an episode of CSI or something that I had seen to where they even send out the same myth where they say, well, the only possible way would be as if they were identical twins, because that's the only, you know, and they're talking about the fact because they always have identical DNA.
Exactly.
So not only are we getting it in, you know, passed on from generation to generation, but now television is projecting that to us. And I know that in your book you illustrate, you know, kind of the mixed messages that you know, about healthy child development that is presented in the media. You draw on examples from a variety of contemporary TV shows and feature films. I know it's everything from Modern Family to Mad Men to Moonshiners and Meet the Fockers. So how did you decide on the examples that you included in the book, and why? Or was it just they all had to begin with M?
No, yeah, the publisher cherry picked out all the ones that start with M. But, I mean, part of it is I just watch a lot of TV and I love movies. And so, you know, the more I learn about myths and child development, you saw something on a TV show and I see it, I'm like, oh, that's something I'm writing about right now. And so, a lot of those examples are shows that I watched or my co-author Jeremy Jewell watches. But sometimes we would also just like throw out a myth out to the college students and that they would they would tell us some examples. So one just told me an orange is the new black example the other day, but it didn't make it into the book, but because the book's already out. But I was like, oh, I wish I could have orange is the new black in there. That would be a good one.
So what was the what was the myth that they shared with you that has come out in that new show?
So I don't watch that show. I just know it's a really popular show, and it's in a prison. And so one of the myths we talk about is this idea of scared straight programs. If you have an older child or a teenager that's done some early crimes, maybe shoplifting or something, you'd take them to this prison, and then the prisoners would yell at them and basically, you know, prevent them from ever committing a crime again. It's a pretty popular notion. A lot of people believe it's effective, but research shows it's not effective. And I don't even know how it was portrayed in Orange is the New Black, but I'd sure like to see.
Now, you mentioned, and one of the ones that I mentioned, but it's because you mention it in the book, which is Meet the Fockers. Now, I have, and this isn't, I don't know that this is necessarily a myth, but I used something from the Meet the Fockers in raising my own children, and that was the fact that they know that I am also a detective, you know, and that's what they knew Dad was. And when they were very, very young, they didn't really know exactly what that meant. So I was,
right.
I was somewhere between James Bond and that cop they see on the street somewhere in the middle. And so I started something before Meet the Fockers ever came out, but where I would take their pulse. And then I would drop my head and say, you know, oh, man, I can't believe that you're not telling me the truth.
Right.
You know, at this very, very early age. And so they had this perception that through my training, I could take their pulse. And it got to the point that when they would have other kids, you know, over, and they'd be playing in the backyard, and somebody did something and something hit the window. And so I came outside and I said, okay, well, you know, who did that? And one of the kids started to lie, and one of my sons ran up and put his hand over his mouth and said, "Don't lie to my dad. He'll just take your pulse, and then the consequences are double. So just tell the truth." So anyway,
it's such a great dad moment. I just heard another dad moment. Somebody said that they told their kid that when the ice cream truck is making music, that means it's out of ice cream. So it's kind of. I thought that was another good dad moment.
Well, so tell me, what was what did you find in Meet the Fockers that was a myth for you to discuss in your book?
I had to stretch it a little bit, but so there was this one scene where they're trying to get the child in the show into like this really fancy, elaborate preschool, and they use like his drawing abilities, and in particular some of like the hidden meanings within his drawings to determine if he'd be appropriate for this preschool. And that was one of our chapters, this idea that psychologists can use what's called projective drawings to kind of learn the deep subconscious of children.
Well, in fact, yeah, I was just going to say, when you said that, I know that is one of the chapters, and so what you're saying then is that the child's drawings do not provide insight into their subconscious or any cause of their problems?
Exactly. There's quite a bit of research on it. I mean, if a child draws a soccer game or something, then yeah, that might be a sign they like to play soccer. But it doesn't mean that just because they drew a tree in the background in a certain shape that they've got some kind of sexual feelings towards, you know, their parent or something like that, which is what some traditional psychodynamic psychologists have suggested.
Now, in the book, you contrast some of the stereotypical behavior kind of with your own top 10 list of what was the most surprising but yet true. Now, you know, share with us, you know, maybe a couple from your list of something that may have surprised you the most while you were putting this book together.
Okay, well, I guess one of the studies that came out while we were working on this book was that when a fetus is in its mother, some of the cells actually travel from the fetus, some of the fetus's cells, to the mother's brain and actually stay there. And that was they'd known about similar versions of this, but not this specifically. And so I thought that was quite shocking. And we say in the book that you know, you're always on your mother's brain, and that's why actually some of your cells stay behind.
See, now I just learned something. I didn't know that one either.
Another one I thought was good is that I thought interesting. I learned that little fetuses actually suck their thumbs in the womb.
Yeah.
And that is somewhat predictive of which, if they're going to be left-handed or right-handed, which thumb they're sucking dominantly in the womb.
That's another one. So that so now I know how I became left-handed, and it didn't matter how hard my dad tried to correct that. He needed to have corrected it long before I came out, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think there's a long history of parents trying to turn their left-handed kids into right-handed kids. I'm also left-handed. I think that's not as big a deal these days, but definitely something people have done in the past.
Now, I don't know if this was was there any other things done from the left-handed standpoint? Because there's now all of this stuff that talks about the fact that it's the people that work more in their right brain, which means that they're more creative. So there's a lot more left-handers in the more creative fields. Was there any of that type of stuff that came out?
I didn't dig into that at all. It's that topic kind of equally applies to children and adults, and we were given the instructions really to focus on just kids for our book. But I think there's probably some interesting myths related to left-handed and right-handed and ambidextrous people. So maybe that could be another book.
There you go. And if you decide, let me know, because I've done a few little tests in over the years to touch on that subject. So
well, we could pull from Ned Flanders on The Simpsons. He's got the left-handed store. So if you like a pop culture reference, we could go with Simpsons.
There you go. Now, unfortunately, I've never watched that, but but now I know where where to go for that. So now, as far as you personally, what are some of your favorite, factoids, the things that you found out while you were co-authoring?
I guess one of my favorite factoids is that a woman who is already pregnant can get pregnant a second time while she's pregnant. So maybe even like a month later or so, like she could be pregnant for about a month and then the next month to get pregnant a second time where she's carrying two babies at the same time, but they had two different conception dates. That kind of blew my mind when I learned that.
That blows my mind too. Now, if that's the case, is then literally she's going to have one and then a month later she would have the other, or would she have both of them at the same time the first time around?
It's very rare, and I think it can happen both ways. My sense is it's probably more likely to, since they're just a month apart, and once you start delivering one, they go ahead and both come out, but I'm sure there's some variability to that, just like a lot of things.
Wow. You know what? We have an instant message coming in right now from a listener, which, again, I thank those that take the time to either call in, instant message in, or send us emails ahead of time. This one is an email, but it says, I am a new mother, and when I saw this topic, I immediately started posting the show on my social media so that other friends who are young parents could tune in. To say that we are a little lost in the woods is an understatement, especially when I see so many kids with serious issues who are growing up in what looks to be great home environments. My question is, do the traditional methods of raising kids that my generation believe are correct actually work? Thanks. I have already purchased your book, and I'm looking forward to listening to your viewpoints.
Well, great question, it partly depends what she means by the traditional methods, but if I were just going to summarize what tends to work best with kids is two traits. One is parents that are fairly responsive to their kids, and so, they're warm, they use some level of praise, they care about their kids' needs. We call that responsiveness. And then the other trait that tends to be associated with good outcomes is demandingness, meaning that they set parents to set some limits, have some rules, have some degree of supervision. If parents can balance out both fairly high, moderate to high amounts of responsiveness and moderate to high amounts of demandingness, that's associated with the best outcomes for kids.
Wow. Now, it's interesting, the word you're using is demandingness. What's the difference, I guess, between demandingness and structure?
I would say structure is, and demandingness is kind of a technical term that is in the psychological literature for this, but I would say structure is part of demandingness. And so, you know, parents do want to have some level of structure for their kids. At the same time, I think you can overdo the structure. So structure would be like just one component of demandingness. Another component might be making sure they follow through with instructions that the parent gives to the child.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. My kids don't, but I do.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that when I was in the other position, probably didn't like it. So let's talk a little bit more about some of the myths for those of us that remember some of the myths that were there. Tell us, you know, is this true? Is this not true? Or whatever. So let's take the bed sharing promotes attachment between child and parent.
Yeah, so bed sharing is, we kind of talk about it in the broader context of a type of parenting called attachment parenting. And it's one of the components of getting parents to do some very specific things to promote attachment. And unfortunately, with attachment parenting, the types of things they're recommending don't really have research support. And there's really not research to support that sharing the bed with your baby is going to build your relationship with them. And it's actually discouraged from the American Academy of Pediatrics because there are some safety risks in sharing a bed with a baby.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's one myth out the window. Another one, you know, will showing, you know, cognitively stimulating videos or music, you know, from an audible standpoint to babies boost their intelligence? I remember, being told that, by showing, really positive videos and playing classical music was going to boost the intelligence of my children.
Yeah, Mozart music was a really kind of popular idea in the 90s, to play Mozart's music for your fetus or your baby. When my kids were a little younger, you know, we were buying like Baby Einstein DVDs and showing them these, you know, interesting shapes and figures and puppets on the DVD. Largely we did that on road trips just to keep them occupied. A lot of parents and the companies even sell them as educational products, and so a lot of people believe they're going to make the music or the videos are going to make their baby smarter, but there's really not good research to show that that is something that improves intelligence.
So see, there's another myth out the window.
But it might improve appreciation for Mozart.
There you go.
So it's not to say they could be all bad. But really, the best way is the more traditional ways in terms of just interacting a lot with your own kids.
Now you touch on something in regards to like the findings about parents who use baby walkers for their children. What was your findings in regards to that?
So with baby walkers, I'm referring to those wheeled devices that the baby or younger toddler kind of half stands in, like yep. Fred Flintstone's car, and moves themselves around. And a lot of people, they've actually been used for centuries, and a lot of people believe that they help the baby learn to walk more quickly. And so that was our myth, this idea that the baby walker actually helps them walk more quickly. And we only used myth that we could find research on, and there's quite a bit of research on baby walkers. And they either don't work at helping you walk more quickly, or if anything, some research shows they might slow down walking by about 2 weeks because they're not learning to use the right muscles.
Oh, okay.
And, And just like co-sleeping with babies has some risks, baby walkers have some risks too. And so babies can walk themselves right down the stairs. Because of that, they've been banned in Canada. I thought that was one of the more interesting things I discovered while working on this book, that there's a nationwide ban on baby walkers in Canada, and it has led to a baby walker black market.
Ooh.
People are probably like smuggling them across the border right now.
Wow. You know, you can see in a dark alley, somebody pulls up with a van, gets out, looks both ways, and holds his hand out, slip me the cash, and pulls out a baby walker, and then races off into the darkness.
Yeah, it works in my mind the same way it works in your mind. Yeah, I think that could be a fascinating TV show right there, is the dark world of baby walkers.
So, now, what about, and I think this is something that probably goes back to the beginning of time too, but the concept of imaginary friends, how does that work in regards to, either being socially good, socially bad for children?
Well, one of my favorite movies is The Shining, and in The Shining, the kid has an imaginary friend and talks to his imaginary friend quite a bit. And as we see as the movie plays out, or the book, his imaginary friend is quite creepy and gets him to do very creepy things. And there's actually a new show out now. I haven't seen it. It just came out this summer. I'm not sure what it's called, but it's about an imaginary friend that a kid has, and the imaginary friend is telling him to do bad things. I think because of TV and movies, we have this idea in our culture that imaginary friends are really creepy, because really friendly imaginary friends just don't make for good TV. And when we look at the research, one of the findings we discovered was that about half of kids have imaginary friends. Mm-hmm. And so that finding alone should tell us that they're really probably not very dangerous. And some research shows they even could be associated with good social skills.
All right. Well, I like that. So at this point then, so what you're saying is it's sort of there is no real in other words, the myth is neither positive nor negative. It's just...
Yeah, I would definitely say there's no harm if your kid has an imaginary friend. And there's also, if your kid does not have an imaginary friend, that's no big deal either. Whether or not your child has an imaginary friend is not something I would really worry about. Now, the only thing I would worry about is if their imaginary friend was telling them to do bad things, then that would be something to be cautious about. But that is rarely the case. And I bet there's a lot of innocent imaginary friends that probably get blamed for bad things that were done.
Now that one I believe, and probably used...
Yeah, they're probably scapegoats a lot of the time. I bet the imaginary friend in The Shining, if it were a real story, really didn't tell that kid to do anything creepy.
Yeah, just the scapegoat.
That's right. That would help people look at that movie in a whole new light, where the imaginary friend is just the scapegoat.
I love it. Well, we're going to take a break, but I'd like everybody, please stay with us. We're going to be right back. And if you would like to follow along, if you would like to go to Stephen's website, it is stephenhupp.com, and that's STEPHENHUPP.com. You can go to the website. You can open up another. Don't close us out, but you can open up another window. You can follow along with us. Obviously, if you're driving out there, don't try this. But, just stay with us. We're going to take a break. We will be right back. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And you're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. And our guest today is Dr. Stephen Hupp. And we are talking about his book, Great Myths of Child Development. Now, Stephen, there's a topic out here in California that gets voted on from time to time. And there's people that have some pretty strong opinions in regards to it. And that has to do with childhood vaccines. Tell us a little bit about if you touched on that as an issue and what your findings were.
Well, out of all the child development myths out there, this is the one that's probably the most well-known and gets the most attention in the media and also in the skeptical community. There are different myths surrounding vaccines, but the big myth that we talk about anyway is this idea that vaccines cause kids to have autism. And this idea has been really studied a lot in the last decade, and it's not that hard to study. It's complicated, but, I mean, you can pretty much find groups of kids that have been vaccinated and groups of kids that have not been vaccinated and look to see if there's differences in rates of autism between those two groups. And study after study shows that there isn't difference in rates of autism between those two groups, and so it's very clear that vaccines do not cause autism.
Okay. Was there any other myths in regards to any of the other vaccines and stuff? Because, you know, one of the things is that when I hear people talking about it is that, you know, we've gone from, you know, over a couple of generations, we've gone from getting, you know, two or three shots to getting, you know, a whole lot more shots for the kids. Was there anything else other than the connection to autism that was that you searched out in your myth busting?
We didn't discuss much more. I mean, that's such a big topic. We focused on that one. It did come up in the presidential debates a few years back with this idea that vaccines cause mental retardation was stated by one of the candidates running for office. And also, that is another myth. Vaccines don't cause mental retardation, or now we would say intellectual disability. It was just the term being used at the time. But it is true that we do get more vaccines now than we used to, but we've also eradicated or nearly eradicated a lot of diseases because of those vaccines, and so they've had a lot of positive effects. Unfortunately, because people have been getting fewer vaccines, or some parents have been choosing not to vaccinate their kids, some diseases that we've pretty much have wiped out from this country, we're starting to see them come back in little pockets. And so earlier this year, we had an outbreak of the measles, stemming from Disneyland, I believe.
Yep.
And so it is something, it's definitely a serious issue.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think we have on the ballot here in California now that they're trying to set it up to where if the parents choose to not get their children vaccinated, either through religious or whatever their belief is as to why they're not going to do it, that their children are going to be kept out of any of the public schools. So that's the latest thing on on the front as far as politically out here. So now, in regards to some of the other hot buttons or great myths, what about spankings?
Oh, yeah, so spanking is a topic that gets people's attention whenever you talk about it. I think we could go two different ways with myths about spanking, but the one we focus on in the book is we just took the old proverb, spare the rod, spoil the child, and asked the question, if you don't spank, does that mean your kid is going to become spoiled or have behavior problems or be whiny? And so we were able to find enough research to show that you can raise a kid without spanking, and they can grow up to have, you know, be just fine and not have a lot of behavior problems. And so we kind of debunk this myth that kids need to be spanked. Now, in terms of what I was saying earlier with demanding this, kids do need some structure and some consequences. And so part of what that proverb is, what's the definition of the word rod in that proverb? Does it mean spanking or could it just mean discipline? If you spare discipline, you'll spoil the child. That one, that idea I could actually support. But when I talk about spanking, I also kind of like to go on the flip side of it, and I think sometimes people send the message that if you have spanked your kid once or twice or a few times, that's going to ruin them for life too. And that's really a myth also. Kids can be spanked a few times as long as it's, you know, fairly mild and isn't causing injury not really have problems. And so there's myths on both sides of that debate.
Yeah, I mean, and that makes sense, and that's kind of what happens, I think, sometimes with any myth is that people take things to the extreme on one end or the other, and it sounds like with one like that, the reality is probably somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, really a lot of the topics we cover in the book, I think we try to find the happy middle ground really try to use the book to calm parents' nerves on most topics. Just kind of send a message. There's not one right way to parent, parents have a lot of choices, and most parents do a great job. But parents also struggle sometimes, me included. And so in the book, we include a lot of other resources to point parents in a good direction in terms of finding evidence-based approaches to dealing with different challenges of childhood.
Which is great. Now, another myth, and now as we take this back to kind of tie it into, you know, more of a pop culture, or at least our television culture, I recall when there was a lot of conversation about breastfeeding of older children. And like many things, when it becomes a big issue and people start talking about it, Saturday Night Live does a skit on it. So,
okay. Did they do a skit on this? I didn't see that.
They did a skit on breastfeeding, I remember, in regards to the woman who had come out. I guess she was the head of a breastfeeding organization that was saying that it's completely a positive thing to breastfeed your child, you know, and I forget what the age was that she was saying, but they took that and obviously took it a great, you know, 10 steps further and did a skit where the woman, you know, behind the podium had, you know, what was another adult, but probably was supposed to be like a teenage child,
right.
You know, breastfeeding behind the podium. The myth in regards to breastfeeding kids as they get a little bit older, what did your research find in that area?
Well, I'll just open by saying that American Academy of Pediatrics does recommend breastfeeding for most babies with most mothers for about a year or so, exclusive breastfeeding for the 6 months, but then continuing for up till about a year, maybe more. And so breastfeeding is generally a good thing to do. I think kids who don't get breastfeed, they can grow up to be just fine, but there are some health benefits associated with it. But the myth we tackle is breastfeeding used in the context of attachment parenting, which I talked about earlier, this idea that you're doing breastfeeding to build on the attachment in the relationship. And in attachment parenting, they're recommending extended breastfeeding, like what you were talking about probably with that Saturday Night Live skit. And so in extended breastfeeding, some people are encouraging it for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years. I've even seen 7 years. And one of the pop culture references I didn't get into the book, I just realized recently because I've been binge-watching Game of Thrones, but this little lord in Game of Thrones, he gets breastfed until he's 10 years old. So that's really taking it to the extreme. We really could not find any research to show that extended breastfeeding promotes attachment. It's good to do some breastfeeding for a while if you can, definitely 10 years is on Game of Thrones, but even 4, 5, 6, 7 years in attachment parenting circles is probably not helping people reach the goal they really want to reach.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you know, when you were doing your research in regards to attachment parenting, at what point is attachment too much? In other words, there's the the concept of if you become too attached, you never leave the nest, or something like that. So, did you do any research in regards to this, the concept of attachment parenting, and how much is too much?
We didn't really kind of get to that. I think that's a very interesting angle and something, I guess maybe you're making me want to dive into more now and try and get a better feel for it. But, I mean, obviously, we all want to have a good attachment with our kids, but at some point they can be too attached, like you said, and maybe not feel comfortable leaving the house or, with other people. And so where's that line? I don't know, but I'm sure kind of interested in the topic.
Well, it sounds like what I'm doing is I'm establishing my place as a consultant in your next book.
That's right. Well, I'm just not shy about admitting when I don't know something. But everything I don't know is fodder for another book. We are working on trying to make another book happen. We want to do the sequel and do Great Myths of Adolescence. And we're trying to get our publisher to give us the green light on that.
Well, In that area, I would love to offer up any wisdom I might be able to share. And with what we've done for the last 30 years in transporting at-risk youth, that may be an area that we could touch on and be of some help. Now let's go back to the really, really young kids, though, and that is the toddlers. You touch on in your book a little bit about the terrible twos. So the question is, do toddlers really go through a terrible twos stage, or is that just a myth?
Well, I've heard about the terrible twos my whole life, and when my son was turning one, he was starting to exhibit some ornery behaviors, and I use that as evidence that he was advanced because he's only one and he's already entered the terrible twos phase.
There you go.
And I hear other people kind of say it on the back end, like, oh, my kid was an angel at two, but at three or four or five, that's when they became, ornery. It just earlier this year, Kanye West said he went through the terrible twos stage when he was 35. And so people just whenever they have their behavior problems, they just call it the terrible twos. So it made me want to look up, like, is two the time? Is that when it peaks or when most kids have the most behavior problems? And the research we could find, 2-year-olds do have some new behavior problems, but so do 1-year-olds and 3-year-olds and 35-year-olds.
Yeah, I'm glad that I'm glad that Kanye owned up to that. I like the fact I'm a big one about taking responsibility. So I'm glad that he owned up and put a tag on his behavior.
He did. I think soon thereafter he jumped on stage again and interrupted somebody else's award. Uh-huh. So I don't know if he has left the terrible two stage yet, but I haven't officially assessed him, so I'm not making any claims.
Yeah, that's that could be a whole nother chapter of how long does it take some people to get out of it? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's maybe some people just don't ever leave the stage.
Well, another question, and I know that. So I'm going to go to the birth of my first son, and at the time in which he was born, and it was a wonderful experience, and I was right there, and as soon as he came out, and we wiped the Varna from the eyes and wrapped him up in a blanket, which was interesting too, because the head nurse said, how is it that you know how to do this? I thought this was your first child. And I said, it's not that different than wrapping a burrito, and I've been doing that for years. but they, she then, after everything was set, she took the baby and she said, it's important that, that within this first hour that we place the baby with the mother so that the baby begins the bonding process. So here, I had a head nurse who was of the belief that this thing that we've been told, since for as long as I can remember, how important it is that you get that baby into the mother's arm within that first hour. What did you come up with in regards to that myth?
Well, that is particularly important for baby chicks. If, like, a baby chick does not see his or her mother within the first hour or especially within the first day, then they won't really imprint onto their little duckling or goose mother and won't follow them around the way they should, and that's dangerous. But when we look at is this a good metaphor for humans bonding babies with their parents and their mothers in particular, it really doesn't hold up so well. And so I think it's great for mothers and babies and fathers too to be able to spend time together right after the birth. Sometimes it's not possible due to medical complications, so they have to be separated. I like people to know that just because you've been separated, that does not mean that there's going to be a lifelong attachment problems like some people have suggested.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. And I didn't realize that there was research that you could find in regards to that. So that part's great. Now there was another little myth that I remember, which was, can parents really predict the sex of their child by examining the shape of the mother's body? Because I can remember, you know, somebody coming up to my wife at the time and looking at the shape and saying, "Oh, you're going to have a boy."
Right.
And she's like, "How do you know that?" You know, we went to the doctor and they asked if we wanted to know, and we said, "No, we don't want to know. Don't tell us." And yet now this stranger comes up and decides that they can tell us.
Right.
So, you know, is that something that is true, or is it just a myth? Because, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, you're going to be, you know, even if you just guessed, you're going to be right at least 50% of the time.
Yeah, that's the tricky thing there, that a stranger was right half the time they made that guess, or, you know, they could have been even more accurate or less accurate. But this was another Game of Thrones one, that this season of Game of Thrones, they were predicting the sex of a baby, and it's really important in Game of Thrones if it's going to be a boy or a girl, based on the shape of the mother's belly. And I was so upset that I wasn't able to get that pop culture reference in the book also. The one we did get, we got it from I'm thinking the wrong one, but from Cake Boss. We used one from the show Cake Boss. But to answer your question, you're right. People can do that at about 50% accuracy, but the shape of the belly is really not predictive of if you're going to have a boy or a girl. In fact, it's really kind of hard to classify different shapes of bellies, because it's not like bellies come in two shapes, boy shape and girl shape.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, and that was kind of my thought also, is that we as humans all have different shapes, so how can you do that? But yeah, I just think it's one of those things, you know, half the people are running around saying that the person that, you know, made the guesses is brilliant, you know,
right.
and half the people, you know, have gone on to ignore it and move on to other things. So
well, one of the things we do in the book is try and get at the why do some of these myths persist. And so the kind of one of the backdrops of this myth is this selective perception. And so this person might tell 10 different people what the sex of their baby is going to be. And for the 50% of them that they were right, the people are like, "Oh my gosh, he was right. He predicted he was right." They tell all their friends, This guy was able to predict it based on the shape of my belly. For the other half, the people that he was wrong, or the stranger was wrong, they just don't think that much of it. Yeah, he was wrong, no big deal. They don't talk about it. They don't go tell all their friends. And so it doesn't, the wrongs don't get shared, but the hits, the times they was right, get shared and talked about in a bigger deal and remembered more, and we call that selective perception.
Yeah, I think that's the way that some people that work in the stock market work as well.
Yeah, I could believe that.
They just pick, and half the time those people will tell somebody else that the guy was right, or girl. So we have another question that has been emailed in. This one reads, we run a child care center for ages 6 months to 5 years. There is a dramatic difference between the children who start with us at an early age and those that come to us when they are three or older. We have been looking for more successful strategies to implement that help bring them structure more quickly. Would your book be helpful for my staff to achieve this goal?
Oh, gosh, I'd like to say that it would. And actually, I think it would. Obviously spend a lot more time debunking myths, but we do try to point out evidence-based practices. And we do talk about daycare, first of all, and say that we debunk this idea that daycare hurts the parent-child relationship. But beyond that, when we talk about, like, the terrible twos, like behavior problems tied to the terrible twos, we do talk about some research-supported strategies for dealing with these types of things. And kind of getting back to my comment earlier about responsiveness and demandingness, those are different ideas that I think daycares or parents could use to help shape kids' behavior.
Now, you touch on something else that I'd noticed, and it had to do with the myth in regards to sex chromosomes. And this one I didn't completely understand, but if you can share with us about your research in regards to sex chromosomes of all girls being XX and all boys being XY. Share with us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was one of my favorite ones to write about, partly because I'm not trained in genetics, and it's basically a whole myth dedicated to genetics and sex chromosomes. And so I had to learn so much while I was writing it, but it's such a fascinating topic to me. And so it's another one of those things where in a child development class you would learn that boys have an X chromosome and a Y chromosome, and that's what makes them boys. And girls don't have a Y chromosome. They have two X chromosomes. And you often would walk out of class just assuming that's how it always is, that all boys right. are XY and all girls are XX. And that is how it is most of the time. But there is a lot of variations possible. And so every once in a while, you can have somebody who's got an X and a Y chromosome, but their body is resistant to the hormones that essentially the Y chromosome or part of it causes to release at different points in development. And so because of that, they're XY, but they basically develop as females. And they look like, if they're born looking like a female, they grow up looking like a female, they think they're a female, their parents assume they're a female, and that, for all intents and purposes, they are female, but when they try to get pregnant, they're not able to get pregnant, and then they get their chromosomes tested, and then they find out they're actually XY. And that's just one of many, many, many different examples we talk about in the book. There are some people that are XX but develop as male. There are some people that have more than two sex chromosomes, so they might be XYY or XXXXXY. There's some people that are a little bit of both. There's just so many different variations that it's both fascinating, it's confusing, but it really kind of breaks down your image of there only being boys and only being girls. There's a lot of variability.
And see, I just learned something as well, because I remember, I mean, from science, that's what I remember, you know.
Right, sure.
You know, that's, they said this, and it's funny because, you know, in some classes, you know, you would test things, or you might not buy into something or whatever, but usually anything that had to do with human development or had to do with science, you think of it as an absolute. So you don't challenge it. You just kind of move on, and that is one of them. Now, and I'm looking – oh, my God, we are almost out of time. Real quick, you know, where can listeners buy the book and or get more information about you, as well as what is next for you? Do you have seminars coming up? Are there things that we can do to follow more about what you're doing?
So probably the easiest place for people to find the book is on Amazon.com, Great Myths of Child Development. I also spend a lot of time on Twitter, Stephen Hupp, S-T-E-P-H-E-N-H-U-P-P. And then the next thing I'm excited about, I just got accepted to present at this conference called The Amazing Meeting. It's going to be in Las Vegas. I'll be presenting on July 19th. And it is kind of the world's leading conference in critical thinking and skepticism. And I'll be presenting on different myths and pseudoscience related to child development. And it's in Las Vegas, so it's extra fun. And it's organized by the James Randi Educational Foundation.
That's great. Will there be more information on that on your website as well?
I haven't put anything on there yet, but I will tweet about it.
Okay, that is great. And for those of you, if you're driving, if you can't write those things down, go to Answers, the numeral 4, thefamily.com. Go to our site. There will be plenty of information in regards to Stephen as well as his site information. Stephen, thank you so much for coming on. I look forward to talking to you again. So when you come out with the next book or the next myth you want to bust.
I would love to. Yeah, I really enjoyed talking to you. Great questions and comments, and thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you. And for everybody else out there, be sure to tune in next week as our guest is Sean Taylor, and he discusses the highly acclaimed documentary Lost for Life, which asks the question, can juveniles who commit murder be rehabilitated? And be sure to follow us and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Have a great week, and be with us next week. Bye now.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Marvin Smith, right here on LA Talk Radio.